I know they were unsafe, they were dangerous, but doggone it, they were so much fun. And if it weren't for the dumbing down and the sissifying of this country we live in today, we'd still be able to play with jarts. Now, some of you are too hoity-toity to call them jarts. I think you might refer to them as lawn darts. These mini Zulu javelins that we would give our seven-year-olds, and then we'd tell them, throw it down there near that hula hoop where your baby sister is crawling. Right? How many of you have ever been hit by or penetrated with a jart? Let me see your hands. That's most of us. That's awesome. My cousin Bobby, cousins were over, and I'll tell you how it happened, but the gist of it is from 40 feet in the air, it landed in his shoulder and went down about 3.5 inches and stuck there. And if it weren't for that safety washer, do you ever notice they put them safety washers on there? If that safety washer hadn't been there, that would have went right through him all the way to Australia. I mean, it was... So what happened was all the cousins are over, and we're in the house, and all three TV stations go off the air. Now, you young people have no idea how that happens, but it does. We had three stations only, and they all went off the air, and then there was an American flag on the screen on our black and white TV. And then after the flag and the national anthem was beep, just this long beep. And honestly, if you were sleeping and the beep woke you up, you thought you flatlined. It was bad. But that's how it was. So we're in the house, it's late, and all of a sudden I had this great idea. Hey, let's go out and throw jarts up in the air in the dark and see what happens. So we had 12 jarts, and there were 6 of us. So that's one for each hand. And so we stood in a circle, Corey, you'll like this. I call this game Calvinism. Because whoever the jart landed in was bound and determined to get it, right? I mean, it was meant to happen. So we're in a circle, and on the count of 3, we're going to throw them all up in the air, and you can run any direction you want, because you don't know if you're throwing it straight up or out a little ways. And so we threw them up in the air, and that's when one came down, and Bobby took it in the shoulder. And he's screaming like a little girl, and he's running to the house, and we're trying to stop him because we know that when one kid gets hurt and goes in the house and wakes up the adults, we're all going to get hurt. But he gets to the house before we can stop him, and instead of going to his mom and dad, who were staying all night with us, to their room, he went to my dad's bedroom. I could have told him he was wasting his time. He goes to my dad's bedroom. He's got the jart in his shoulder. There's blood everywhere. And he says, Uncle Logan, I got a jart in my shoulder. My dad, without even getting out of bed, looks at him and says, pull it out and walk it off. You know, it dawned on me fairly early in life. I'm part of the walk it off generation. I am. And when I go back home, and they tell stories like that, or there's a crowd there, almost invariably somebody will say, I cannot believe there's a church somewhere that lets that boy preach to them. You all are that church. So Jesus goes back home in the story that we want to read today, and the response to his ministry from those people who knew him as a little boy may not be what you expect. I have never preached a whole sermon on this passage, 40-some years, never. I've alluded to it, but I thought, you know what, this is really interesting to me, so I want to share some thoughts with you today. They all come from Mark, the 6th chapter, and we'll start with the first verse. Jesus left there and went to his hometown, accompanied by his disciples. When the Sabbath came, he began to teach in the synagogue, and many who heard him were amazed. Where did this man get these things, they asked. What's the wisdom that has been given to him? What are these remarkable miracles he is performing? Now, if we stop right there, we say, that's good. It's amazing. They're amazed by all of this. But then the tone changes, okay? And we go from that to verse 3. Isn't this the carpenter? Isn't this Mary's son? The brother of James, Joseph, Judas, Simon? Aren't his sisters here with us? And they took offense at him. Jesus said to them, a prophet is not with honor except in his hometown, among his relatives, and in his own home. He could not do any miracles there. Highlight that. There's something Jesus couldn't do. Doesn't say he would not. You'd be more comfortable, wouldn't you, if it said he would not. It says he could not do any miracles there except by his lay his hands on a few sick people and heal them. Wow. Side note, and we won't go into this, but there are many who do not believe Mary, the mother of Jesus, had other children, and Jesus had no siblings. I'm not sure what you do with this passage if you believe that, because it just listed some brothers, and it mentioned his sisters. But let me tell you the phrase that jumps out at me, and I just mentioned it. He could not do any miracles there. How's that hit you? Thought Jesus could do anything. I look to the original language because this troubled me, and it conveys that he was unable to. Evidently, there's something Jesus could not do, and that was override the unbelief of the people. He wanted to heal, he wanted to serve, he wanted to save. So while he had been out literally changing the world, his own hometown did not view him as a world changer. They were amazed at all the things he was doing, but then he was amazed at them, verse 6. He was amazed at their lack of faith. Then Jesus went around teaching from village to village, so he left his hometown. So let's talk about Nazareth for a little bit, his hometown. Nazareth was 25 miles south of Capernaum. I don't know if that helps you or not, but Capernaum was Jesus' base for his ministry because he could go all around the Sea of Galilee, and that's basically where his 3 years of his home ministry took place. And he's having success, and now he's going home to his hometown. So Nazareth's a small town. When Jesus grew up there, there were a few hundred people in Nazareth, but now, today, I think we've got a picture of today's Nazareth, there are about 80,000 people in Nazareth today. I think of, when I think of hometown or small town, I think of John Mellencamp. Remember the lyrics? I was born in a small town, I live in a small town, probably die in a small town, oh, those small communities. I cannot forget the people who love small town and people where it is that I come from. I cannot forget the people who love me. I can be my words might ring true for Mellencamp, but those last two lines did not ring true for Jesus. They weren't willing to let him be who he was. So he comes back home, brings his disciples with him, and he gets that kind of reception, which leads to this thought. Sometimes when you get too close to something, it becomes too common. Jesus seemed to do better with the sinners than the religious. Of course, the religious were sinners too. I get that. But the way the prophet said it, Jesus came to his own, and his own received him not. Now, let me talk to you for a minute about all the things you take for granted because you're too familiar with them. They've become too commonplace. And what you used to be amazed at, or what you used to compliment, or what you used to cheer, you're not doing any of that anymore, although the same things are happening because you have grown comfortable with that. Haven't you ever just wanted someone to notice what you're doing? Notice that you've been trying and that you care. I'm old enough now to be past this, but when I first started preaching, and people would give me advice, well, you need to preach about this, and you're too many jokes in your sermon, and that sermon was too long. And one lady, that sermon wasn't long enough. I thought, you know what I need to do? I need to turn the pulpit over to everybody in my church and let them have a stab at it and see how stinking hard it really is to do this job. That's how I felt. It's like, really? You think it's that easy, huh? Give it a shot. On our church staff, we have Derek and Jimmy both serving in their hometown. I don't know if you ever thought of it. I'm sure you've thought about that. And they both do a great job, but I'm telling you, that's an exception. To prepare for this message, I called a bunch of my college preacher buddies. The only time I ever communicate with them, it's on the phone. We never get together. I wish we would, but none of them. I said, have you ever been invited to preach in your hometown? Because I have not. None of them have either. And there's some pretty good preachers out there, and they've never been invited to their hometown. My hometown is Vivi, Indiana. There are churches in Vivi, Indiana. Shoot, even Kat Von D goes to a church in Vivi, Indiana. Never been invited to preach in 40-some years. Tom Selleck used to deer hunt in Vivian, Indiana. Did you know that? And my mom had a thing for Tom Selleck. But my dad knew about it, so it was okay, I guess. They're very honest with each other. One night, Fabio came on the TV, and my mom, she was doing something, but when he came on, she goes, "Oh my, look at that." And my dad's like, "What?" But my dad said, "Listen, you take away his long hair, his strong jawline, his tan, his muscles, his good looks, then what do you have?" Mom said, "Well, then I have you." There are lots of churches in Vivi. I've never been asked to come and preach. I think I know why. I guarantee you, if you had asked anybody when I was in high school if I would have ended up being in ministry, they would have laughed uncontrollably. They would say, "You mean that boy who rushes on all the recruited people to go cow tipping, that boy? That boy who painted mustaches on all the statues of Mary in the town of Canaan, Indiana, that boy? That boy who started a food fight at the high school cafeteria that landed 12 kids in court, that boy? The one who tried on the way to school every morning to hit a speed limit sign with a Mountain Dew bottle and missed every time until the one time he nails the sign, it comes back and hits on a state trooper's windshield. What are the chances? That boy? The boy that sat by the side of the highway impersonating an officer with his moped and his helmet on and his mom's hair dryer as cars went by? That boy? And there's much more history you all don't know, and let's keep it that way, okay? Good luck getting anyone to believe I would ever end up in ministry. Now, I'm not trying to say it's just like Jesus, because he was perfect as a kid, as a teenager, but the Bible gives evidence of the truth that a prophet is without honor in his own country. We could go to Joseph. How'd he get along with his brothers? It didn't work out so well. Jeremiah was thrown down in a well for speaking the truth to fellow Israelites. Isaiah was cut in two for sharing the truth with the home folk. And Jesus was without honor in his hometown, which brings up another thought closely related to that one. Sometimes if you're around something long enough, you cease to be amazed by it. That's us parents who have multiple children. We don't treat the fourth one the way we treated the first one. We don't. Let's be honest. Same with grandkids. You don't treat them all the same. You just don't. You grow complacent and comfortable with the fact that they're there. I mean, that first baby, Jared and Nikki, my son, he lives on the south side of town. I mean, they freak out if her little, what's that thing they plug her whole, Binky comes out. I mean, they'll scoop that thing up and sterilize it like they're in a lab somewhere before they'll put it back in her mouth. Wait till they get to the fourth child. Fourth child spits that Binky out, they pick it up, they put it in their own mouth, go, mm-hmm. So I remember my first kid, I thought I was going to break him. You know, he's so small, and you haven't experienced this before, and I would lay him in the crib, and I'd make sure my elbows were up, so I didn't want to hit the crib and drop him, and I'd put him in there, and just so gentle, and just back away, you know. Second child, I'd hold her over the crib and drop her. Third child, be a one and a two. And thought we were done. We had a fourth kid. Get to bed. What has happened? I'm not trying to be some kind of word nerd, Micah and Corey, but it turned out this way. Let me say it this way. The moment you categorize something as common that was sent to be special, you trip over the miracle because you miss it in the mundane. Let me help you understand that thought. You husbands, some of the things you used to be amazed about in the woman that you married are some of the same things you're complaining about 10 years later. You gals used to think your man was mysterious when you got married. He never said much, and you thought that was cute and amazing. And 20 years later, you're upset that he doesn't talk enough. You fellas, you know how good your girl looked when you went for a date. She came out for the date and she looked so good. She was amazing. But the reason she looked amazing is because at that point you didn't have a glimpse into the process by which she looks amazing. 10 years later, you realize she's in there and it's taken her 2.5 hours. And what used to be amazing is now annoying. What's the old saying? Familiarity breeds contempt. Well, it breeds something else, too. It breeds complacency. So when I'm going through this story and thinking about how Jesus changed the world, a thought kind of hit me that I want to share. In one way, when people take you for granted, it's sort of a compliment. It speaks to your consistency, right? It's why your kids never say thank you when you feed them. They expect it. They're used to it. If you took away food for 4 days and water for a week, and then you finally gave them some chicken nuggets, I'm pretty sure they'd say thank you. Now, this may not be what you want to hear, but sometimes you can know you're getting good at something when people stop telling you, good job. Because it's just what they expect from you. And they stop complimenting because you're consistent. If I say to you, thank you so much for doing this on time, that's not a compliment. What that says is you often do not do it on time, and I'm shocked that you did it on time this time. So Jesus comes back to town, did what he does, uncelebrated, unappreciated, unnoticed, unrecognized, but he did what he could, which leads to my third thought. Sometimes what is consistent, here comes Jesus to his hometown, Nazareth. He's coming from a scene where he raised a 12-year-old girl back to life. She had died, and he brought her back to life. And on his way there, a woman touched his garment. She had an issue, that physical issue, and she was healed because she touched Jesus. So that's what he's doing on his way to his hometown. So ever since we started streaming our services, people from lots of different places have started listening. I forgot to show the picture, Jamie, didn't I? Is it possible to get to that? Let me show you a picture. Thank you, Jamie. That's Jane Nichols in the middle with her husband Mike on the left and her son Mick from Indianapolis on the right. We baptized Jane Friday, and it was very exciting. She was so excited, so sincere, committed to the Lord, and she wanted to get baptized. Let me tell you how she found out about our church. They lived in North Carolina, and their son was in Indianapolis, and they knew they wanted to get closer to him, weren't sure where they were going to land. And so they started searching for churches in Indiana online. And they found us. And after watching us, they kept watching us and worshiping with us every Sunday from North Carolina. Didn't know anybody here. Had never been invited here by anybody. Just started watching. Decided then that they would move close to the church, still be close enough to their son, but instead of moving to Indy and being right by their son, if they moved here, they could come to church here and still see their son. So they moved to Springville. And they've been coming for a long time, but they were watching for months online from North Carolina because we were streaming our services. That's who streaming is for. Now, I'm happy for anybody who watches. I am, but doggone it, if you're just using it as an excuse to watch our service in your pajamas while you eat Cap'n Crunch, that's not what it's for. If you can be here, you ought to be here. But I'm thankful that we're doing it. And I want to say, and Donnie, you led right into this, I appreciate our church. I appreciate my staff, my church staff. I should tell them more often. I think they know I do, but I need to say it. I appreciate you all, my church family. I really, really do. We have a vibrant worship service. We're continuing to grow. We're seeing new people come almost every Sunday. This is not happening everywhere. It's not. And we're not perfect. I would never suggest to you we are. But not every church gets to experience the things that we do. And we should not take it for granted. We had a bird loose in here this week. It was above the tile, and then it finally got out, and it's flying around the foyer, and we'd heard it different places, and it was a big mystery. Where's the bird now? And it got loose in the foyer when we were all there. I have never seen two grown women scream like five-year-old girls like Darcy and Jamie did. A bird's flying at it. You would have thought it was a pterodactyl from Jurassic Park. I mean, they were freaking out. And finally, I think the bird hit a window. We heard it go thud, kind of dazed itself, and then it hobbled down the hallway. And bottom line, Kurt got it out of here. But it made me think of a preacher who said that his church, they didn't have a bird problem, they were having a rat problem. And they didn't want to kill them, which I don't understand at all. So they tried to trap the rats. That didn't work. Well, then they tried to politely ask the rats to leave. That didn't work either. So I said, well, what'd you do? He said, well, we baptized them and made them members, and now we only see them on Christmas and Easter. So I was talking to someone a couple of weeks ago whose church is down to 30. And they're singing now without instruments. They're not a non-instrumental church. They have instruments. They have absolutely no one to play them. Talked to a buddy at the Lighthouse Christian Academy who has a church within an hour and a half of here. And him and his wife are having relationship issues because he's fighting with his church leadership on a weekly basis. It's bringing him anxiety. It's making ministry a burden. He said to me, I don't even look forward to going on Sundays. That's foreign to me. I can't wait to get to the pulpit. So I felt guilty when he told me that a little bit, but I felt guilty and glad at the same time. Because we have something special that we should not take for granted. I don't want to take it for granted. I guess what I'm trying to say is sometimes it might be easy for us to just let it be another Sunday. But I'm telling you, trust me, what we have is not that common, and I will not take it for granted. If I was writing this in a book, go ahead, Rita, thank you, that's right. If I was writing this in a book, I would say it this way. I refuse to let my blessings be overlooked in my familiarity. But the people have lost their appreciation of Jesus' power. I mean, they could appreciate the miracles and all of that until they equated those miracles with who was doing them, and then it blew their minds. Can't be him. We know that guy. So there's got to be something else going on here. I was in a revival in Fort Wayne years ago, and we sang the old rugged cross, the old hymn, and there was a lady in the front row, and tears just flowed down her face. And she's the only one we were under a tent. She's the only one that was emotional while we sang the song. So I talked to her afterwards. She had been in the church when she was little, fallen away, hit some hard times, and now was coming back and just appreciated the truth that Jesus died on a cross. And it made me wonder even then, when's the last time any of us shed tears because the message of a church song went straight to our heart? Times. Without it really touching your heart. And I'm not condemning, I'm telling you that's natural. It's natural. We become too familiar to be amazed. Well, I want to do something about that this morning. I want to tell you that there is still power, wonder-working power in the precious blood of the Lamb. And I am still amazed by it. Amen? Amen. So let's say it together. Let's say I'm amazed. I'm amazed. Say it like you mean it. He's the one who loves the heavens and the earth. The one who flung the stars into place with his hand. He's the one who loves us. I'm telling you, I'm amazed at that. And that creator gave me free will. I could choose to walk away from him if I wanted to. He gave me that choice. And I choose to love him. But I'm so thankful that he gave me that choice. I'm amazed. He gave me the means by which I could reach him, and that was his son, Jesus, and I'm amazed by that. He gave me a church that is such a blessing to me and my family, a church that was there to weep with me when I was weeping, and a church that rejoices when I rejoice, and I'm amazed by that. And I can talk to him every day. I have his ear anytime, for anything, anywhere, I'm amazed. And that same Creator preserved and protected this perfect word of his so that I could read all the amazing things that he has done and that he has planned. I'm amazed. I don't want to grow so comfortable with those things that I'm no longer amazed. I'm amazed at all that God does. Amen? Amen. And all that God continues to do. Speaking of amazed, let's go back to verse 2. When the Sabbath came, he began to teach in the synagogue, and many who heard him were amazed. Where did this man get these things? What's the wisdom that has been given him? What are these remarkable miracles he is performing? So they don't deny his miracles. They don't. They just can't understand, because in the next verse they ask, isn't this the carpenter? They don't even use his name. He's from a town of about 400 people. They know his name. Isn't this the carpenter? It's like a slight. And then they ask, isn't this Mary's son? You don't do that in Jewish custom either. You would never do that. You call the child by the name of the father. Now, maybe at this point Joseph is dead, but you still call the child by the name of the father. You need to remember, for these people, Mary gave birth to Jesus in some questionable circumstances. Mary said it wouldn't prove God who got her pregnant. But these people didn't see the pregnancy test. How are they going to prove that? So they got some questions about that. They didn't know if the angel was telling the truth. I mean, we know Mary was his mama. I mean, they got the same nose. We understand all of that. But that daddy thing, I don't know. You see, it wasn't what he did that they doubted. It was where he came from. He's one of us. He can't be that special. Now, what would make them think like that? Well, I'll hit one more passage and then I'll wrap this up, because this, I didn't really think about this till just a few weeks ago. There's one of the disciples that only says one thing in Scripture. Maybe there's more than one, but there's one that only has one statement, and his name is Nathanael. But he has another name. He's called something else, too. Anybody know his other name? Little Bible? Very good. Bartholomew. So Bartholomew is his Hebrew name. Nathanael is his surname, first name. And in the Bible, he says one thing. So I want you to understand what he says. And the only thing he says helps us understand what's going on when Jesus comes back to his hometown. John 1:45. Philip went to look for Nathanael and told him, "We've found the very person Moses and the prophets wrote about. His name is Jesus, the son of Joseph from Nazareth." Nathanael's response, the only thing he says in the Bible, verse 46. "Nazareth?" exclaimed Nathanael. "Can anything good come from Nazareth?" "Come and see for yourself," Philip replied. That's the only thing in the Bible he said. You know who that made me think of? Allen Iverson. I'm a sports nut, and I remember a press conference that Allen Iverson gave. And Bob, this is why I say practice is overrated. Listen to Allen Iverson for just a minute.
"It's easy to sum it up when you just talk about practice. We sitting here, I'm supposed to be the franchise player, and we're in here talking about practice. I mean, listen, we're talking about practice. Not a game. We're talking about practice. Not the game that I go out there and die for and play every game like it's my last. Not the game. We're talking about practice, man. I mean, how silly is that, man? We're talking about practice. I know I'm supposed to be there. I know I'm supposed to lead by example. I know that. And I'm not shoving it aside, you know, like it don't mean anything. I know it's important. I do. I honestly do. But we talking about practice, man. What are we talking about? Practice? We're talking about practice, man. We're talking about practice. We ain't talking about the game. We're talking about practice, man.
So I can hear Nathanael. We talking about Nazareth. We ain't talking about Jerusalem. We're talking about Nazareth. what good can come from Nazareth? Here's how this applies to you. There's a part of us that's able to believe God is great, but when we try to reconcile the reality of his greatness with the reality of our brokenness, we start to push him away. That's what we do. It's not that we believe he can't be great. It's just that we can't believe anything good can come from our life because we know where we're from. We know who we are and what we do. And we just can't believe that God could do anything with us. I don't think the people of Nazareth were rejecting Jesus as much as they were rejecting themselves. There's a teacher who wanted to teach her students about self-esteem, so she asked if anyone in the class thought they were dumber than a box of rocks, would they please stand up? Well, none of the kids moved, so she said it again. If you think you're dumber than a box of rocks, would you please stand up? And little Charlie Scott stood up. And the teacher didn't think anybody would stand up, and she said, why'd you stand up, little Charlie? And little Charlie said, well, I didn't want to leave you standing there all by yourself. Now, I know I have belabored this point this morning, but here's the bottom line of what I want you to get from this passage. You have to develop your view of who God is through the prism of who you think you are. And if you believe for the rest of your life that you're worthless, it'll be very hard to worship a God who thought you were worth dying for. Has a direct effect on that. So let me wrap it up, and here's a teaching point, and I've never put these two together. So he leaves his hometown, they reject him, and he tells his disciples, we're going to go out two by two and share the word in Matthew 6:6. He was amazed at their unbelief. Jesus went from village to village teaching the people, and he called his 12 disciples together and began sending them out two by two, giving them authority to cast out evil spirits. He told them to take nothing for their journey except a walking stick, no food, no traveler's bag, no money. He allowed them to wear sandals, but not to take a change of clothes. Wherever you go, he said, stay in the same house until you leave town. But if any place refuses to welcome you or listen to you, shake its dust from your feet as you leave to show that you have abandoned those people to their fate. How about that? You see what happened here? He not only showed them before he came back home how to love people and how to teach people and how to be with people, now he's given them a lesson in how to handle rejection. So he takes them with him to his hometown where they can see, well, these people ain't listening to him. And from there, he takes them out and he says, go to house, and if they don't listen to you, then move on. That's phenomenal to me. Reminded me of Psalm 118:22, the stone that the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone. Jesus showing them how to handle rejection. If they will not listen to you, leave that place and shake the dust off of your feet. He showed them how to shake it off. Man, do we need a lesson in learning how to shake it off? It's not always going to go like you want in your life. Everyone's not going to see things the way you want them to see them, and all the right moves are not going to be made. They're going to be mistakes. If you will shake it off and move forward, you'll see who you really are and what a mess you can make of things, but who Jesus really is and what he can do with the mess that you've made. All of that time spent with Jesus, those two important truths are realized. You and I are sinners, and Jesus is our Savior. I can see the people in Nazareth. Man, I don't know if that's him or not. It looks like him. Is that him? Somebody else? Yeah, that's him. I used to sing a song, and the lyrics said just that. A tender blade of grass so green, crushed by the footprint of the Nazarene, sprang back with a message to a bird on the wing. That's him. In a river out in the noonday sun, an outcast is preaching. I'm telling you, he's the one. And a voice from heaven said, I'm pleased with my son. That's him. Angry waves splashing everywhere. He's asleep in the boat. Doesn't he even care? We're so afraid, and he's just laying there. That's him. He raises his hands over his head and yells, peace be still, and the waters are dead. A wave taps the wind on the shoulder and says, shh, that's him. with 1 foot on sea and 1 foot on shore, he will declare time will be no more. The trumpet will sound like never before. And that's him. Alpha, Omega, beginning and end. I'm telling you, church, that's him. That's him.